the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events. Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. What I'd like to do, David, today is look at the Fed and try to do a report card here. Let's look at before the Federal Reserve and look at inflation and some of those numbers and then say, okay, after we put an organization in that was very clearly mandated to stabilize prices, how have they done so far? So let's look at the before and the after.
Well, I think we have our own opinions as to how effective they've been, certainly over the last few years. And if you roll the clock back, Ken Rogoff has reflected this way, saying inflation rose 20% in the 138 years until the Fed's founding in 1913. Then 3,000% since 1913.
Now, we're not talking annual 20%. We're talking 20% in the entire 138 years before
the Fed. That's correct. Yeah, so that's sort of a net number. You've got periods of inflation and deflation. When you go from beginning to end, where did you start? Where did you end up? That was about an inflation of 20% in spite of some relatively volatile years in between.
That sounds like we had more price stability before the Fed than the mandated price stability after.
Well, the volatility that we have today is just in one direction. The dollar buys less and less with each year that passes. So our suggestion, yeah, the Fed should be graded, let's say on a 10-year rolling average. And, you know, again, we just keep to their basic mandate. Price stability was the mandate. What part of 3,000% represents stability?
Well, you know, I think of monetarism. Okay, we've criticized Keynesianism over and over and over. And Dave, I think it's worth criticizing. You know, Keynesianism basically says don't save money, spend money. Don't pay correct interest rates. Go ahead and keep them at zero if you possibly can to keep people spending and keep people going into debt. Well, that's ridiculous. But, you know, there was monetarism. Okay, Milton Friedman came in and he said, you know, Keynesianism may not really work, but I'll tell you what you can do. You can control monetary policy and that'll solve all the problems. But, you know, Philly Fed President Charles Plosser is basically, he's denying that at this point.
Absolutely. You know, when he looks at the situation today, and there's a growing number of people at the Fed who would say, listen, this isn't working. We know it's not working. It's not like we have a better solution. And a part of the reason we don't have a better solution is because the folks who are running the fiscal show don't have their act together. Plosser said this, a monetary solution to fiscal problems is a bridge to nowhere at best and a road to perdition at worst. And this is what they've been pursuing, the monetary solution to fiscal problems. We need to tighten our belt. And then that word austerity is almost like poison to those in Washington, D.C., and certainly it's not popular because there is a real cost to austerity. The problem is without it, what you have is what Plosser describes the monetary solution being a bridge to nowhere at best and a road to perdition at worst. We have a bridge to nowhere here in Durango. Every time we drive underneath it, my 7-year-old son looks and says, look, that's the work of Obamanomics. Why? Because we needed intervention at the time. We needed to spend money on infrastructure. They're suggesting spending more money on infrastructure today. And what did it get us here in our lovely town of Durango? A bridge. Do you know what? I have never seen a vehicle on that bridge, and it's been there for 3 years now.
Well, and you know, when you are a Fed president or a Philly Fed president or any of the regions, you're indicting yourself when you say that monetary policy is not working. Now, what's interesting is the current monetary policies have this dual mandate. We've talked about it before. It's been contentious all the way along because they have price stability as their first goal, but then the second goal is generating economic growth so that you have employment. Well, you know, it's impossible to control the two.
You know, I like Richard Fisher. I think he's one of the best of the Fed presidents there in Dallas. And generally speaking, if you look and sort of, I'm not suggesting we cut off the West Coast and the East Coast, but where you have your money centers, and maybe Chicago fits into that too somewhat, but where your major money centers have a positive inflation bias. Meanwhile, you've got folks who are dealing more with the working class Joe and companies across the country, the midsection of the country, which are a little bit more grounded in their perspective. And so you find St. Louis Fed chief, you find Kansas City, you find Dallas with a slightly different tone. And Fisher this week said that for 6 of my 8 years at the Fed, we've been working to bring the nation's economy out of recession. This was a speech that he gave this week talking about how their policies have basically created a Gordian knot. He says, I've been working for 6 to 8 years to bring the nation's economy out of the recession. The fiscal authorities have, for the most part, been AWOL. during this time, having left the parking brake on during their absence. The result is that our balance sheet has ballooned to more than $3.5 trillion. The efficacy of this effort is the subject of significant debate, even internally within the FOMC. Any CEO, CFO worth their salt running a company that's large, medium, or small, whether publicly or privately owned, has by now taken advantage of this to restructure the liability side of their balance sheet. And he's making some good points, but one of the things that he's basically saying is, listen, we've done this to fill a gap, but ultimately you're going to have to do some heavy lifting. And I think this is really what's at stake. The current monetary policies have been more or less contentious since inception. And they're growing more contentious by the day as the evidence of ineffectiveness is mounting.
Well, and I think we should have a definition of terms here, Dave. For the person who doesn't understand the difference between monetary policy and fiscal policy, what we're talking about, monetary policy, is in the hands of the Fed. This is what they're going to do, printing money. Fiscal has to do with the government. It has to do with tightening the belt.
It has to do with just keeping a budget. I mean, just like you and your household may look and say, this is how much money we make each month, this is how much money we spend. We either have a surplus, that is, extra money at the end of the month, or a deficit. In other words, you didn't have enough money, so you had to go into debt to finance what are your sort of household needs. The government's no different. So on the fiscal side, we're just dealing with budget issues, how much money's coming in and how much money is going out. The monetary side has everything to do with the creation of money and credit. And that's what the Fed is responsible for, the creation of money and credit. And then the further distribution through their various central bank hubs, these regional hubs, into the banking community.
Well, and I don't want to be sympathetic necessarily with the guys at the Fed because I don't care much for them, any of them, frankly, Dave. But, you know, the challenge is being a central banker, you're stuck between conflicting mandates. In other words, are you going to print money and keep the economy rolling at the risk of ultimately turning into a hyperinflationary collapse of the dollar? Or do you tighten things up and force the government into a conclusion?
You know, I guess one of the reasons why I appreciate Fisher is because he continues to read, and I know he's been reading Ian McCavity. He quotes him, the U.S. is the best-looking horse in the glue factory. That comes straight from our friend Ian McCavity and his newsletter, Deliberations. Weak as we've been, we're the best compared to all the rest. That's how he concludes his speech and his position. On a relative basis, we probably are better off than Brazil today, China today. We have a leg up in many regards, but here's what has happened. The challenge for the central bank today is that they're stuck between the rock of deflation on the one hand and the hard place of suboptimal growth. So between a rock and a hard place, deflation on the one hand, too much debt in the system that needs to be unwound, and slow to zero growth in the economy, GDP is averaging 1%. And that does not explain the number of jobs being created. Ordinarily, when you have growth that's that low, GDP growth that is that low, that rate of growth, jobs, which they're assuming is 185 to 200,000 jobs a month, they can't be explained.
Right.
It doesn't match the economic input. There's not enough happening for those jobs to be created, which is to the point. These jobs are a statistician's pipe dream. They are seasonal factors. They are birth-death modeling. They are part-timers replacing a once predominantly full-time workplace. And there's a large swath of Americans leaving the labor force either due to discouraged efforts finding a job or simply reaching the age of retirement and saying, okay, I've had enough.
Well, and David, if you're with the BLS, you've got to admit, these guys come in and they say, okay, we're going to have to come up with birth-death models. We have to figure out how many guys are discouraged and coming off the polls. In a way, it's a little bit like, okay, guys, it's Monday morning, 8 o'clock. Pick a number between 1 and 100,000, and we'll use that.
Well, that's correct. It's not as if this is just sort of creativity out of the right or left pocket. You know, we're not talking about folks that should have been creative writing majors. No, they were mathematicians. They were economists studying econometric models. And so they do have a variety of mathematical assumptions as they creatively come up with these numbers, which end up being revised later on anyways. I mean, this is the irony. No one seems to pay attention to that. We'll talk about it in a minute, I suppose. But the GDP revisions of late, again, last quarter was revised down steeply. Now we're dealing with, on the basis of expectations, 2.5%, 2.4%, now down to 1.1%, about a 53% reduction from what was expected in the first quarter. So there is a trend of note going back to the issue of retirement and unemployment. There is the large increase in the labor force at older ages, that segment, again, that you would assume that most people 50 to 70, there is at least a thought in the back of their mind, maybe at some point I want to retire.
But
I don't know when.
Right now, Dave, interest rates are too low, so they're staying in the workforce.
And it leaves fewer openings for a younger professional set coming out of college. Okay, so let me reverse that and say that does not take away from the ever-decreasing labor force. The major improvements in the most recent jobs numbers were due to this factor. The labor force participation has been shrinking. That is, there are still, even though more people are staying on to work, we are still dealing with that bubble in terms of population, the baby boomer generation, which is coming into retirement. And in spite of a lot of people staying on, there are massive amounts leaving the labor force, and that is what is shrinking that unemployment number.
So when you shrink the overall number, then when you hear the percentages, you're actually talking, even if the percentage goes up, sometimes you're talking about fewer and fewer people.
Right. So the stats were 7.6 is where we began last week, and we finished the week at 7.4. How did we get there? If you take the pool of people that are working age and shrink the pool and divide that number by those currently working, and as the pool shrinks, the percentage employed improves, mm-hmm. boosting the percentage left, which is the unemployed category. So you shrink the total pool and divide by the same number of those employed, the unemployed number goes down, not because of new jobs created. In this case, it's because of simple math. It's a statistical reality, even if it's not a real reflection of the jobs market. Let me illustrate. So let's say you take 1,000 people that are in the labor pool, mm-hmm. and 900 are working today. That gives you a 10% unemployment number. You keep the 900 still working, but shrink the pool to 950. So it shrunk from 1,000 to 950. Let's just assume those 50 people retired. Guess what? The unemployment number drops to 5.3% mm-hmm. from what was a 10% unemployment number.
So it looks like a huge improvement.
Looks like a huge improvement, but you still have just the 900 that are working.
Right.
So no jobs added, yet the number was improved because the size of the labor force shrank.
Well, David, one of our favorite guests that we have on a pretty consistent basis is John Williams. And he being an economist and a statistician who reports accurately the various numbers so that we see after the revisions what they really should be.
And it's coming in about 10%. If you're not looking at John Williams stuff on a regular basis and you're just looking at what you might find, even with disparate opinions on Bloomberg and CNBC, everyone would say, Keith Hall, others at the BLS, folks who have left the BLS, folks who are just sort of thumbnailing it and saying, I think I have an idea of where unemployment is, it's about 3 to 4 percentage points higher.
Right.
Now, that doesn't get us quite to U6. U6 is 14%, so U3 7.4 is the most recent number, U6 14%. And then John Williams' alternate measure of unemployment, which takes out all of those seasonal factors, all of the adjustments we were talking about earlier, he comes up with a number that's closer to 23.3%.
Which is shocking, because the Great Depression, those are numbers that are very similar to the 1930s.
Right, so I mean, I would probably fall into the camp somewhere closer to U6, between 10 and 15%,
right.
Which I think is quite realistic and a reflection of the real labor issues.
Well, and speaking of John Williams, you know, something that shocked me this week, Dave, after they just added over $500 billion to our GDP just by changing the way they calculate it, we've seen little or no mention in the mainstream media that that was just a falsified number.
No, they were gleefully reporting a 1.8% growth number for the second quarter. That is GDP growth for the second quarter.
Well, and they added $560 billion, Dave, out of thin air.
To the economy, they added 560, and that's by recategorization and basically new accounting. Things that were considered expenses now can be considered as investment and an improvement to the overall economy. And as we mentioned last week, the greatest absurdity, in my opinion, was counting pensions when they're accrued as to when they're paid out. So you have government investment now increased by $30 billion. And that improvement in the economy is supposed to be a reality. It's a pipe dream. It's a total fiction. And yet, this is the irksome part. The mass media looks and says, look, we were surprised. We were expecting 1%, less than 1%. It came in at 1.8%. They're neglecting the artificial source of growth, completely neglecting it, not even bringing it up, and neglecting to emphasize the reduction in first quarter GDP, because it was originally, if you recall, estimated to be 2.4 to 2.5. then reported at 1.8, and then revised to 1.1. Mm. But that revision gets ignored as sort of a negative data point. Because
it's not news anymore.
It's not news anymore.
Yeah.
And that's the problem with statistics. You have to actually look as much in the rear view as look in the present and future, because they keep on revising things on a more or less constant basis. What they said yesterday, they can't be held accountable for. I mean, Cicero said something like that. my position today, I can't be held accountable for what I said yesterday because things have changed. Well, you assume that there's some constants when you're just doing math. It's not just sort of a rhetorical flair, which may take you in a different direction. But this number is changing.
Yeah.
And what we're finding is that it's becoming more politicized all the time.
Well, an apple is not an orange, and an orange is not an apple. A full-time job is different than a part-time job. And, you know, these employment numbers that are coming in, they're not really giving us specifically how many of these great full-time jobs are now being turned into part-time jobs.
Right. Well, that's 953,000 jobs have supposedly been created in 2013. If you look at that, you know, close to a million jobs, guess how many of them were part-time? 731,000.
Oh my.
Basically, three quarters.
Yeah.
Three quarters of the jobs created were part-time jobs. So, great. This is wonderful. The land of the free, home of the brave, is now the land of burger flippers and those working at Dairy Queen on soft serve machines. That's a brilliant thing. I love it. Where we've been, where we're going, this is amazing.
And David, even though we are Western-centric in the way we think, let's look at gold price here for a second. Gold price has been struggling around $1,300. You know, granted, it's added about $100 over the last month, but people are saying, gosh, are we in a bear market in gold? Nobody seems to be buying gold here in the West yet. In the East, Dave, I mean, the numbers are coming in and they're gigantic.
Oh, I know. And this is where if you don't pay attention to the details, you assume that price is actually relevant in here. And it's not.
Yeah.
The value of gold is appreciated in other parts of the world. And the price, and certainly the price volatility, means nothing except that there's a greater opportunity. That's the way it's being treated in Asia, delivered through the Shanghai Gold Exchange through the month of May, 918 tons of gold.
Hmm.
Now, year-to-date global mine production is about 1,134. So we're talking, and this is from George Topping at Stifel Nicolaus. He notes that we're basically at a 50% annualized run rate. China is buying the equivalent of 50% of new mine supply. That is an appetite that seems to be growing with the eating.
Well, and I think we have to look at why that appetite is actually consuming so much gold. I mean, we started after World War II with a gold standard for the world under the Bretton Woods system. We said, look, you guys use our currency as a reserve currency. We're going to pay you in gold if you need to redeem dollars. Now, of course, we've talked about this many times before. We reneged on that promise. And for the last 40 some odd years, we've been running with a dollar that's purely fiat. Now, at this point, the Asians seem to be accumulating their own gold. I don't know whether it's for their own Bretton Woods system, but, you know, this weekend there was a comment made that sent chills down some of our spines.
Right. So that raises the issue of how did we end up with so much gold in the first place? Through World War I, World War II, we're one of the only places that wasn't completely bombed out. And, you know, of late, we've been responding to requests from those that we had done business with. World War I, World War II, post-World War, there were gold deposits kept in our country,
like
by
Germany.
Other central banks,
sure.
Germany specifically, and it was because we were a safe place. They wanted part of their assets someplace else. We ended up with over 21,000 tons, and from about 1950 to 1971, we whittled that down from 22,000 tons down to about 8,000 tons of gold. That's why Nixon had closed the gold window and suspended convertibility, U.S. dollars in gold. That reneg, is what you described, was the end of the Bretton Woods era. Last week, a member of the Monetary Policy Committee at the People's Bank of China, Yao Yudong, called for a new Bretton Woods agreement, called for the IMF to play an enhanced role, which is essentially a diminished role in the U.S., a non-governmental body, essentially, to be coordinating and organizing this. And I can only assume that the yuan would play a larger role. Now, remember that you've got the trade agreements, you've got the currency swap lines already in place this past year. And this is between China and France,
right.
China and England, Australia, Japan, Russia, Iran, Brazil. Those are just a few.
They're working around the dollar, Dave. The reserve currency status was designed so that you would not work around the dollar. Everything needed to be done at least midway through in dollars.
Well, so the dollar's reserve currency status in the singular is approaching an end, and we should all be thinking ahead. We should all be planning ahead, and hopefully we're not forced to be making decisions on the basis of an announcement. But I think one of the announcements we can expect in the not-too-distant future is a new number being given. The PBOC, the People's Bank of China, updating their gold storage, their gold holdings, from the number that they revealed in 2009. It was years before that, and it was out of date, and it more than doubled. In 2009, they've been acquiring aggressively. I know individual Chinese investors have also been acquiring gold aggressively, but the PBOC has as well. Towards what end? Certainly a greater internationalization of their currency and acceptance in the world monetary system to be a currency that runs in parallel with the U.S. dollar and the euro in concert.
Well, and it goes without saying, there would be no Bretton Woods agreement originally if there was no gold standard.
And we would not have been the center of Bretton Woods.
Right.
That would not have happened in New Hampshire with us being the linchpin of the agreement had we not had the gold. That classic phrase from my dad, he who has the gold makes the rules. And now I'm beginning to appreciate just how much changes from a geopolitical and geostrategic vantage point when you undermine a financial authority by taking the gold away. And it's not being taken away. It's being given away. That's the tragedy here, is that individuals in the West, as well as institutions and even Western-oriented central banks, they're only too happy to let someone else own these worthless, barbaric relics. And the East is looking back and looking at the landscape of history and saying, that's fine. What you've forgotten, we remember. We own the gold. We will make the rules.
You know, I've always thought it would be fascinating to have a book out that would follow history from the perspective of an ounce of gold. An ounce of gold traveling through the world powers, through the centuries, through the millennia. Because really, you could actually define world history by the flow of gold, like what your dad was saying.
And you would journey through Spain. You would journey through Portugal. You would journey through the Netherlands. You would journey through Great Britain. You would journey through America. Now, the question is, as an ounce of gold over the last however many hundreds of years,
are you now in China?
Are you now in China?
Yeah.
Well, we await that announcement, but we think that, again, that's something that we may see this year, even next year.
Well, and to add fuel to the fire, Dave, we've talked about the difference in paper price versus the real price. There's a lot of mines, especially in Africa right now, that cannot mine gold for a profit.
The CEO of Goldfields, one of the larger miners in the world today, gold miners, that is, has noted that African all-in costs are at about $1,500 across the industry.
So they're losing money right now.
I had assumed $1,400. He's saying that, no, across Africa, you're looking at average costs of about $1,500. Part of that is that there's not developed infrastructure on the continent. And as such, to operate a mine, you're dealing with bringing in diesel fuel. Everything needs to be brought in order to do your work, as opposed to sort of tapping into the local hydroelectric plant and basically having an inexpensive way of operating. There are no inexpensive ways of operating in Africa. The net effect, and here's the real challenge, we're watching that industry. This year marks the closure of many prospective projects or even marginally profitable projects, which are now underwater.
So supply will be dropping just as demand over in Asia is increasing.
Well, that's precisely the point. You've got a decrease in supplies coming to market from your miners because of these non-economically functional or viable projects. On the other hand, you've got steep declines in recycled gold. And that's, again, we buy gold stores, which everyone has seen across the U.S. and now around the world. As the price of gold has declined over the last 2 years, less and less gold is going into the recycled market. What at its peak was close to 1,900 tons, I would guess, as we tally the end of the year, is about half of that. And so you have a perfect and normal reason for gold prices to rise considerably. That is, supplies are dwindling. Demand has been relatively constant in the physical market. We continue to see weakness in price, predicated primarily on selling in futures contracts, not mass selling in the physical market.
Which is just paper.
Well, then, of course, there's the short covering, which is one more propellant in the years ahead. So note that when projects are shut down, going back to sort of the mine supply issue, when projects are shut down, it takes years to restart them. It's not like closing a factory line where flipping a switch or adding a shift somehow restores previous productivity or production. It takes years to restart a mining project. So you've got supply squeezes, which are around the corner, and physical allocations, in our opinion, for the average investor, should continue to be a major priority.
Yeah, I think that lag time is sometimes hard to remember. You know, I remember the old Doritos commercial where Jay Leno says, munch all you want, we'll make more. Because they could. You can make more corn chips pretty quick. But when you shut a mine down, like you said, the restart could be years before they get into that. But let's go into the price of gold, because even though it is trading mainly on paper right now, and even though the supplies probably are diminishing dramatically, we still have been in this $1,300 range. And so, where should we look at gold as far as support, resistance, some of those numbers?
Well, you know, there's three perspectives that you can bring to any asset class: long-term, intermediate-term, and short-term. Long-term, our view is that gold is still trading in the direction of $3,500 to $5,000 an ounce. Now, what is long-term? 3 to 5 years? 5 to 7 years? I think 3 to 5 years is a healthy appraisal with those prices in mind. Intermediate term being sort of 1 to 3 years, we've got some hurdles to get through, but it wouldn't surprise us to, as soon as 2014 or 2015, be in the neighborhood of $2,200 to $2,700 an ounce. Then in the short term, now we're talking about very different trading dynamics and something that on a day-to-day basis can be tedious, if not just mind-bending. And why does gold go up or down in a given day? Sometimes there's a very clear reason. Other times it's more obscure. We've got the first hurdle here between 1340 and 1360, and that still needs to be cleared. July was the best month since January 2012. We were up 7.3% for the month. That's gold performing very well. That's from the beginning to the end of the month. Now, a slowing of that pace is okay right now. I'm fine with that. It's a little bit like eating. You stop, you chew, you swallow, you allow time to catch up with the movement. And this, I think, is a very healthy pause here in the first part of August, sort of regaining. Again, you add 7.3%. Do you want to do that? Of course, we'd love to see that happen, 7.3% every month from now until infinity. But listen, that's not realistic and it's not healthy.
Well, and silver's a little bit different, but silver's got numbers that you've been watching as well. What are you looking at on the silver market?
Sure. Well, it touched a 60-71 ratio, 67-1 with gold, and it has yet to really deteriorate further. It's sitting today at about a 65-1 ratio. 70-1 has been long in my mind as sort of an outside number. Will we see that? Don't know. If we do, I think it would be very short term. You would see that if gold stayed in the 1300s. And silver retested its lows in the 1860s. And I've noted that silver has been added to my own holdings. We've talked about that here in recent weeks. And we've also done the same thing in our managed accounts, which have, again, been to increase an allocation in silver modestly at this point.
Well, and you know, sometimes there are strange and exotic things. I've always smiled a little when somebody says Indian wedding season, okay, when they say that that's really going to affect the gold market. But we have seen through the years that the wheat harvest in India can sometimes affect the gold price in the fall.
Right. I mean, this is the funny thing. You've got wheat, you've got rice, you've got a number of ag products which are critical to the fortunes of an agrarian economy. So the crops so far this year have had little in the way of surprises. There were some earlier concerns about monsoons, but with a healthy crop in that part of the world, there should be a healthy wedding season and plenty of gold buying with it. That's why there's this sort of classic seasonality to gold. By the time we get to the end of August to see the price of gold picking up again on the basis of the Indian wedding season, we just finished Ramadan. Not any surprise that we actually did see a strong little spurt in the gold price through Ramadan. And now there's some continuation as we head towards that Indian wedding season. There's been some concerns stated, and I think reasonably so, about the official imports being controlled and the taxes being increased on the gold that's being brought into India.
Well, they were obviously concerned, Dave. When you have the government actually trying to control the flow in of something, there's something behind the curtain there.
Well, there is, and I think part of that is that the rupee has been the weakest we've seen in all of history. Relative to the dollar, it's put in new lows. And that's, again, to put in a historical all-time low against the dollar, which is not exactly the strongest currency in the world, that's saying something.
Well, and you know, if you think about it, the officials would like to see full control over their currency, over the flow of gold, but we've seen other examples worldwide that there's a difference between street price and official price.
Right. So the more they increase the pressure on gold, either by an increase in taxes or a limitation in imports, frankly, we could care less. The world doesn't respect anything official, particularly if it seems arbitrary or absurd. I mean, just think about this. Ask the Argentines today how they feel about the official exchange rate. People trade on the street for the real value of an item, not the mandated or controlled value. And if demand is strong in India, official constraints simply shift the supply chains into the black market. And we mentioned this recently with Vietnamese imports in recent years, where over half of all their supplies are actually unregistered and beyond that official quota.
Well,
they've set the same kind of limitations, and yet the black market says, fine, that's good. Now we know how much to import to meet real demand, not just the demand that you're assuming is going to be limited by official edict.
Well, and in a society like ours that is known for its rule of law, now don't smile right now because it seems like that's breaking down a little bit, but I was raised in a country where the rule of law was to be respected. And so, you know, I've grown accustomed to following and obeying those laws, but it seems to be getting harder and harder, not just in India, but even here in America. I'm accustomed to obeying the law. I plan on obeying the law, but survival may mandate something different down the road.
Yeah, there's something of an equation there where rule following is something that we're accustomed to, we expect, and by and large, that is normal. The other side of rule following, in terms of the equation, the quid pro quo, if you will, is where the rule of law is respected at the top. So you've got those who are following the rules, you've got those who are enforcing the rules, and to the degree that the rule of law is respected, then you'll see more rule following. When you have a breakdown in the rule of law at the top, guess what you end up having as well? There's less rule following at the bottom as well. And you see that all over the world. I think you'll begin to see a lot more of that in the United States as well. And again, these are observations which may seem like bad behavior, but consider the existential threat that government is willing to put its people under by depreciating their savings and dishonoring the work of their hands. Think about this. Someone's labor, what they do for a day and their compensation is essentially extorted via our present-day money system, our currency system, and it's thus only natural to prioritize survival and prioritize family flourishing over and above the needs of, should we say, a capricious or even rapacious government.
So I don't have to be patriotic and hold dollars. I can own gold and silver, but I think I should probably also point out that there is a difference between gold as money and sometimes silver as an industrial metal. And I think that should be addressed because many times people say, well, silver is the poor man's gold, but it doesn't always behave that way.
Well, and to that point, you have those who are not respecters of the rupee or of the yuan or of the yuan or of the yen. This is the case all over the world where people say, when push comes to shove, do I trust our central banker to manage my savings effectively? And where did we start the conversation today, Kevin? A quote from Ken Rogoff.
Right.
Inflation rose 20% in the first 138 years until the Fed's founding in 1913.
And now 3,000% since then?
Since 1913. So, I mean, you're asking a lot. You're asking a lot for people to put faith and confidence in the mismanagement, not even the effective and well-managed system, but the mismanagement of our money system. So, again, going back to that notion of capricious and rapacious, that does describe the state today, and it does describe what individuals the world over, not just in the United States, but the world over, do behaviorally to accommodate what is otherwise a system that will chew them up and spit them out.
Dave, going back to what I was asking on the gold and silver, you know, gold has always been a great hedge against government mismanagement, but silver sometimes can behave in an erratic way, and I think it's important to see the definition between the two, especially in the short term. You were talking about the three rungs, you know, the long term, the midterm, and the short. In the short term, you can see the industrial uses of silver move it up and down completely different than the gold market.
Right, so there is a short-term caveat on silver. Even though I've just purchased some, should the industrial metals sell off very hard over the next 90 days? Let's say, for instance, copper is breaking that critical $3 level, and you've got the other industrial metals which are rolling downhill from here. Silver may not be immune to that kind of pressure.
Mm-hmm.
And so again, while I've bought a good number of ounces at 20 an ounce, I would be willing and I'm prepared to lower my average cost again at $15 an ounce. The question is, which of silver's two identities is it wearing in the months ahead?
Is it monetary?
Right,
or
is it monetary
industrial
metal? And if it's the monetary metal, then I have no worries. We've put in the lows and silver is going to do just fine. If it takes on the characteristics of the industrial metal, we have more to give up in the context of a broad equity market sell-off and growing realization of stagnant global growth.
Well, and one of the things that we're seeing here, Dave, is we're seeing premiums in silver still, especially the junk silver, the 90% bags, the dimes, the quarters, the 50-cent pieces. People are still willing to pay out in the marketplace a pretty substantial premium because there's not a lot of supply.
And the same's true for 10-ounce and 100-ounce silver bars, too. So this week, we're not seeing any behavior in the silver market that's disturbing or concerning at all. Silver has yet to break down in any real worrying fashion. It does need to get, as we said, above 20 and then ultimately above 22.50. 50 to really start that recovery process back towards 27 and higher prices. But you recall that products are delayed on delivery. That's
right.
What you're talking about in terms of the physical constraints. Products are being delayed. Their delivery is. And they're selling at unusual premiums. That to us indicates low volumes in terms of liquidations. Low volumes of liquidations into the market and a fairly robust buying of the physical metals themselves. And again, I would strongly recommend the purchase of physical metals. I would frankly even more strongly recommend the placement of some of your assets outside of the United States. Not to sort of scaremonger here, but our government is proving to be dangerous to our liberties and basic freedoms. And this has been noted by Ron Paul in a number of different things he's published this last week. But the NSA issue is really the tip of the iceberg for a state apparatus that is nothing short of totalitarian.
Right.
Even if self-justified along the lines of sort of protecting the homeland. We're on the edge of going too far, and I don't know that anyone has the courage to say, stop, it must stop, this is insane, you have infringed our rights, even those in Congress. We look at the last vote dealing with the NSA, and it's basically a 50-50 toss-up. Half think that we have no constitutional rights worth defending, and half think that this issue with NSA has actually stepped over the line. So, I mean, what do? We have half lunatics, in my opinion, in government. Well, we may have 100% lunatics, with half of them falling on the right line on this issue, but this is, I think, why. If you recall our conversation with Professor Robert Higgs.
Right.
You remember he wrote his book, Crisis and Leviathan. It was an Oxford University published book on the growth of government in America.
He had studied the nature of what happens to a government when it grows to certain sizes, and it continues to grow.
And what is his conclusion? I don't remember if this was in the interview or just off the air as we were talking. Basically said, I'm not going to stick around for a personal encounter with a police state. I'm moving. I'm leaving. You won't find me in the United States in future years.
Well, and this was not some crazy nut that they have a prepper show on. Okay?
No.
This was a guy who, Oxford University Press, he had studied government. He saw that it was getting too big, and he started to realize, this is even before the NSA thing.
I'm the turnip, and they're going to squeeze me for every last drop of blood.
Everything he said on the phone, every email, every text, everything he's done, we're now finding out is recorded somewhere. And just in case it doesn't match what's best in the government's eyes at that time, I don't mean to overstep, Dave, but we now have drones. We have a worldwide presence. In case we need to eradicate something, it's a little bit like that bottle of Raid. I stand back 15 feet from the wasp's nest, and I just go...
You have a real presence at that wasp's nest, even if you're distanced from it, whether it's Langley, Colorado Springs, wherever the command and control center is of the day. I'm worried. But I wouldn't go so far as sort of the Robert Higgs, I'm out of here.
Right.
I don't want to ignore his insights. I certainly don't want to ignore his insights. But I do want to leave all of my options open. And as I think our listeners should as well. That's why I think, you know, we live in interesting times. Why would I implore the discussion of sort of the offshore storage solution for precious metals? I think you should get in touch with our office today. I think that's something that you should explore. That's something that you should do. Because again, just if you understand the definition of capricious, if you understand the definition of rapacious, and you understand the context that we're in historically and see where we're going in terms of sort of the growth of government and where we go from here, you have to understand that you will be squeezed. The only people who won't be squeezed are those who already live in poverty. Anyone with anything will be squeezed in order for the Leviathan to be maintained and flourish. You are a resource, and if need be, will be spent. You will be spent so that the Leviathan can live on.
Well, and David, I can't help but think of the examples where we should be looking east right now. Okay, Cyprus with the bail-in, 47% of all deposits over 100,000 euros. Okay, that's a bail-in, rehypothecation, call it what you want to call it, but basically it's theft. But Turkey, we've had shows in the past few years about Turkey and how they were moving towards a more European type of community, more civilized type of community. But now what we're seeing is that law-abiding society, a rule of law we talked about, that's being thrown out right now for totalitarianism.
Recep Erdogan came into the system at an economic, at a financial low, and there's been growth in the economy. Not necessarily because of the policies he's put in place, but because basically he caught the market at a bottom. So the Turkish lira has done well, the Turkish stock market has done well, Turkish property values have done well, and he is coincidentally the man who was in office when that happened.
Right.
And he's getting the credit for it. And this is what's interesting. There is a certain degree of instability with this man and his regime. Better than the word instability is really insecurity. You find that when his power is challenged, he not only throws the law book at you, but then it basically is punished onto the next generation. We're seeing what was supposedly a coup in their country. And instead of sort of individuals being tried, mass trials of 300 people, where everyone's tried. And again, everyone's thrown in jail. A good many of these people jail for life. And so, I mean, basically anyone in the military who represents opposition or frankly represents the old secular as opposed to the new radically Islamic state, they represent a challenge to his power. This basic level of leadership insecurity, they're just disappearing. They're flatly disappearing. That has the hallmarks, again, of totalitarianism. I hope that we're never in that position where somehow the judiciary ends up being a tool of the executive branch, because that's what's happening in Turkey today. And I hope it's not foreshadowing something that we have in the United States.
Well, and it doesn't just apply to government, Dave. You know, you were talking about the rule of law and it needing to be kept at the top on down. That, in our mind, would first be government, like what we're talking about with Turkey. But also at the top of this society here in America are companies like Goldman Sachs, JP Morgan. Okay. And the CFTC right now is asking, why in the world are you guys so involved in the control of the inventory of commodities? And it's a good question to ask.
What's very interesting to me is that in a low interest rate environment, where basically these banks have free money thrown at them by the Fed, they have lots of new business opportunities that they can pursue. The warehousing of products, collecting a fee for the warehousing of products, whether it's copper or nickel or aluminum.
Aluminum
again,
was the biggie here recently.
They never were in the business, but in a low interest rate environment, there's lots of things that aren't very profitable that become very profitable when you're not using your money. In fact, you're using someone else's money to begin with. So, you know, Bloomberg reported this last week that the top 10 banks earned $6 billion in revenue from commodities in 2012. That's a combination of trading and, of course, facilitating the trade for industry users, including warehousing, etc. No one seems to pay attention to the fact that some of these banks are now collecting fines for malfeasance. And of course, they're not admitting to any wrongdoing. They just pay the fines and move on without admitting any wrongdoing. Prosecution, well, that's pretty light.
Right.
But it has become a good source of revenue for the regulators. Taking the cake, 12% of net revenues, JP Morgan has paid $8.5 billion in fines since 2009. $8.5 billion in fines. That's greater than the market capitalization of many companies that you would consider to be sizable, and yet this is petty change. The point is, there are rules. Those
right.
rules need to be abided by. If the rules are not abided by, then there's penalties for those rules, and that is normal. There should be prosecution when someone's breaking the rules. And you wonder, where do we see the reemergence of the rule of law? If we don't, the consequence will be a breakdown in cultural respect for those who pretend to be administrators of the rule of law. So we are at an interesting juncture. Either we begin to respect the rules at the top, or you will find the respect eroding at the bottom rung of culture and society with no following of rules whatsoever. Lawlessness at the lowest levels of society are simply a reflection of that breakdown in respect for the rule of law at the top. That, again, I hope is not where we're going, but it appears to be that we're taking at least a few steps in that direction.
Well, you've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. You can find us at McIlvaney.com. That's McIlvaney.com. Or give us a call at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.